In Afghanistan, the life that girls and women face gets harsher every day. Now many confront charges of adultery for getting a divorce.
Afghan women know to me repeatedly that what the Taliban are doing are contrary to the tenets of Islam.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today, Navalny. The documentary has shown more people how the Russian opposition figure battles the Kremlin. It's up for an Oscar. One of the movie's key contributors did not see that coming.
Because they thought it's going to be an artsy-fartsy movie that will go to some remote documentary award.
And the economic crisis in Cuba. When this man goes back to visit family on the island, they typically ask him to bring electronics or office supplies.
This time, however, the only thing they wanted was food, just normal food.
All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for joining us. Labor unions in France vowed to bring the country to a standstill today. They planned one of the biggest walkouts by workers in years. Fuel deliveries were blocked. Train service was canceled. Many schools and universities shut down as workers took part in a day of nationwide action. This is the sixth time workers in France have walked out in protest this year. It's all in opposition to the plan by French President Emmanuel Macron to raise the retirement age from 62 to 64. Our Europe correspondent, Orla Barry, joins me. So the union said they would bring France to a standstill, Orla. Did they make good on that?
Well, they certainly caused major disruption. The labor unions are reporting this evening around 700,000 people took to the streets of Paris alone this afternoon, which is, if true, is a very high figure in comparison to previous times. But the police are reporting lower numbers than that. There were over 250 protests held across the country and many services were disrupted throughout the day. So you had intercity train lines, the Paris metro, they were all curtailed. Roads were blocked in several cities by striking workers. We have seen this evening riot police are out in the streets of Paris. There have been some arrests this evening and some scuffles between police and protesters. Workers have also been blocking oil refineries, so fuel deliveries were also reportedly halted today. And there was some talk of panic buying of petrol by some motorists. But the big difference today, Marco, I guess, is that the unions were all united for this day of action. Previously, the unions haven't all been completely on the same page, and this was the first time that it happened. And some union bosses are saying this is only the beginning. You know, one union chief put it earlier, the intention is to bring the economy to its knees until the government backs down on pension reform.
Six national walkouts since the 1st of January. If so many people are not happy about plans to raise the retirement age, why is President Macron determined to push it through?
Well, his argument is that he has no choice, that raising the retirement age is the only way to protect the pension system, and otherwise it'll fall into deficit. And he says it'll leave younger generations to carry the burden. I mean, the thing is, pension reform, it's been one of his election pledges. It was one of his key election pledges in the run-up to the election last June. But he's also been trying to get this reform through for a few years. I mean, he tried to overhaul it back in 2019, in fact, in a more radical way. And then he ended up abandoning it when the pandemic hit. But if he doesn't see it through this time around, it could be seen as a major failure by him politically. And the problem is, as you say, it's deeply unpopular with a majority of the public. You know, not only do two-thirds of voters oppose it, according to a poll yesterday, two-thirds of voters also said that they support the strikes. And it's not just the workers who are striking today. Students, school students were also out protesting this morning. This is Sebastian. He's a student at the Lycée Racine, a public school in Paris, explaining why he was out protesting on French television earlier.
N'en déplaise aux personnes qui pensent que parce qu'on est jeune, ça nous regarde pas. On reste pas jeune toujours, et un jour ce sera notre tour.
So he says no offense to people who think that because you know you're young, it's none of your business. The fact is, we don't stay young forever. One day it'll be our turn. We don't want this reform. We don't want to work until the age of 64 or 70, and we just won't accept it.
Yeah. So two sides in this political standoff: the unions versus Macron's government, refusing to back down. How will this end?
I mean, it's hard to say. The debate on the retirement bill, it continued until 3 a.m. this morning. It started again this afternoon. But there's opposition on both sides. Some far-right politicians are opposed and many left-wing parties are deeply opposed. And the thing is that it's not clear that Macron himself has the votes to get this through Parliament because he doesn't have a majority. So he needs to win over some opposition politicians. There is one last resort option open to him, which would be to overrule Parliament and pass the law by decree. But this would be seen as a really risky move, and it could kind of spark a political crisis in itself that could cause a much bigger headache for the French president.
A tense moment for sure in France. We will keep watching. Orla Barry, the World's Europe correspondent, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
2 weeks ago, the president of Tunisia, Kais Saied, made a controversial speech referring to successive waves of illegal immigration from sub-Saharan Africa that he said intended to turn Tunisia from an Arab nation into what he called a purely African country. Reports of a rise in hate crimes targeting migrants quickly followed. From Tunis, reporter Lilia Blaise has the latest, and a note: some of the people Lilia interviewed did not want to use their full names out of fear for their personal safety.
22-year-old Safiatou is eating some beans with rice on the street in front of the International Organization for Migration, a UN agency. The clothes she is wearing are the only ones she has. Her makeshift tent and bed are made of plastic bags and blankets. She has been camping here with 100 other migrants for a week now. Safiatou is originally from Sierra Leone and arrived in Tunisia last January.
When I came to Tunisia to find my living, because some of my friends told me that Tunisia is good, there is no racism, there is no problem.
She says that she wanted to escape family expectations, that she would be the head of the community, like her grandmother. She also wanted to support her two children who stayed in Sierra Leone. But since the Tunisian president's remarks on sub-Saharan migration, she was evicted from her house by the landlord and left in the street.
Police people chase us and the Tunisia boys chase us from the house, steal our property.
She wants the International Organization for Migration to put her in a proper shelter. But for now, the organization has not been responsive.
Yesterday, they called me for interview. Enter inside here. I told them, we need a rescue. I need shelter to rescue myself because the place is too cold. We are sleeping outside.
Since Saied's speech, Tunisian authorities have been strictly applying the law. No Tunisian property owner can house a foreigner without a residency card. No employer can hire a migrant without papers. Most of them are left with no other choice than returning home. I met with several people in this situation, waiting in front of the embassy of the Ivory Coast, which has started to repatriate some of its nationals. Marie is 35 and has been living in Tunisia for 4 years. It is insane, she says. Here, when you arrive, you can get a residency title only by being a student. There is no worker visa. According to numbers from the Ministry of Interior, there are about 21,000 sub-Saharan migrants in Tunisia. Given the current situation, Marie does not want to stay in Tunisia. My landlord made me leave the house without notice, so I came to the embassy to apply for repatriation, she says. At least 2,000 Ivoirians have already registered to leave the country, according to the embassy. More than 1,000 Tunisians recently flocked to the streets, holding posters that read No to Racism and Black Lives Matter. Oussama Bouajila, an activist, is one of them. It is time to look in the mirror and check the political speech that gave a free pass to people to attack others who are victims, he says. The holy month of Ramadan is only 2 weeks away, he adds, and we are evicting people from their homes. We are demanding the Tunisian government to apologize. We should all act like human beings, he adds. The Minister of Foreign Affairs, Nabil Amar, denied President Saied's comments were racist. He repeated it in a press conference on Monday. Tunisia is known globally for being a welcoming country, and many civilizations have passed through Tunisia, he said. And to accuse us of racism makes no sense, and it's even embarrassing. Authorities are trying to smooth things over by taking measures to facilitate access to residency card for foreign students and the voluntary return of undocumented migrants. For The World, I'm Lilia Blaise in Tunis.
Fighter jets are one of Israel's most fearsome weapons, one of the main reasons a small country like Israel is able to have such a huge military advantage across the Middle East. But fighter jets, of course, need pilots, and right now a group of Israeli pilots are threatening to skip flight exercises. They are protesting the direction Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his cabinet are taking the country. Mati Friedman is an Israeli infantryman turned journalist. He joins us from Jerusalem. What is the latest, Mati, with the pilots' protests? Where do these threats now stand?
The latest on the particular protest that you're mentioning, which is a really unique letter from pilots from the 69th Squadron, which is an F-15 squadron that took out a Syrian nuclear reactor a bit more than a decade ago. And they carry a lot of the kind of heavy lifting in Israel's current operations in Syria. So a very serious Air Force unit. They sent a letter saying that they wouldn't come to a practice exercise that's coming up. And this caused a huge storm in the country. And the last I heard, which was just a few hours ago, they'd backed down. They'd come out with a new statement that said that they're going to show up. But that initial statement did what it was supposed to do, which was it alarmed the political leadership. It alarmed the country, and it showed that the cracks in our society that are being caused by this government are very, very real and are going to have real ramifications for our security.
So the threats, they've backed away. But just remind us briefly of Netanyahu's judicial overhaul and why it is so offensive to so many Israelis and these pilots in particular.
So in foreign coverage of this crisis, the judicial overhaul has been the center, in part just because I think it's kind of an easier story to wrap your head around, and it kind of sounds like an American issue about checks and balances and constitutional intervention and who has the power. Is it the courts or is it the executive? It's actually part of a much bigger picture here, which is the formation of the most extreme government Israel has ever had. And the legal reform comes on top of that. So the legal reform is essentially supposed to remove the ability of the court system to serve as a check on government power. Israel does not have a constitution. Unlike the United States, it doesn't have a second legislature. So Americans have both the House and the Senate. So that's a kind of balance. And of course, Americans also have state governments and state constitutions that give them an additional buffer against federal power. We have none of that in Israel. The only check on government power is the court.
I mean, what you explained there, Mati, shows just how interconnected the Israeli military is with the country at large. And though these pilots have now backed off their threat to not show up for training exercises, they have showed their hand. What is the military hoping for, do you think, at this point? And can you see them upping the ante with the Netanyahu cabinet?
Right. So it's hard to talk about the military as a unified body, because Israel's military, because it's a citizen army, is actually quite fractious. And there are all kinds of people in the military, and they think very different things in different parts of the military, have different political leanings. And people who know the Air Force understand that the Air Force is actually quite a liberal body. And that's not the case with all other parts of the army. But I'm quite confident in saying that what the army wants, and you can really see this in the statements coming out from former military personnel, former chiefs of staff are talking. And what they're saying is this has to stop. The army can't function if people aren't showing up for reserve duty. The army can't function if society is splintering. The army can't function if Israelis don't trust their leaders to send people into battle for the right reasons. So the security establishment in Israel, which is incredibly important, of course, because of Israel's very fragile security situation, is basically begging for some kind of compromise that will allow society to return to normal functioning here. And so far that hasn't happened, but you're increasingly hearing voices associated with the right, people who came out of the military, but lean right, who might have a better chance of getting the ear of Netanyahu, and people in the right-wing coalition saying, listen, whatever the value you see in this legal reform, the price that we're paying in societal cohesion and the price that we're going to pay in our security is just too high, and this needs to stop.
Mati Friedman served in Israel's infantry and is today a journalist, author, and commentator. Mati, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Japan is about to end its COVID pandemic precautions, but the country's elderly population is still feeling the impact from COVID this winter. That story is just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Let's talk briefly about the Doppelpaymer cybercrime gang. Last year, they hacked Britain's National Health Service. 2 years ago, they infected the computers of the University Hospital in Düsseldorf, which officials say resulted in the death of a patient. But on Monday, German police announced they'd caught several people involved in the ransomware operation.
Gruppierung zugerechnet oder zugeschrieben, die den Namen Double Spider.
That's Dirk Kunze, the head of the cybercrime division with the North Rhine-Westphalia State Police. Kunze said police conducted simultaneous raids in Germany and Ukraine on February 28th, seizing evidence and detaining several suspects. The gang is known to blackmail large companies and institutions. They infect computers with malware, effectively holding the content hostage. Sometimes they threaten to leak sensitive data online unless victims pay up. Over the course of a decade, they made millions of euros through blackmail. So shutting down this gang was a big deal, says Alan Liska. He's a ransomware expert at Recorded Future, a cybersecurity firm in Massachusetts.
Right now, ransomware and business email compromise are the two biggest threats facing organizations around the world, impacting literally hundreds of victims a month.
The German operation to stop the cybercrime gang was conducted in coordination with the FBI, Europol, and Ukrainian authorities. Liska says the scale of ransomware threats has prompted international cooperation to stop the attacks. As with many ransomware criminals, Doppelpaymer operates out of Russia. The gang appears to have links to the Russian-based syndicate Evil Corp, which is, yes, apparently the name they go by. And since Evil Corp is based in Russia, says Liska, they are typically beyond the reach of U.S. and European authorities.
Russia is non-cooperative when it comes to arresting and stopping ransomware activity. So essentially, as long as the attackers don't go after targets in Russia, they have a safe haven to act with impunity, and they've been acting as such.
Europol said that over 2 years, victims in the United States alone paid out at least $42 million to Doppelpaymer. Liska says shutting down the gang won't end ransomware, and Evil Corp is still out there, but it is a huge dent in their operations for now. Japan has the world's highest percentage of elderly people, and over the past 3 years, Japan has earned praise for protecting that population from COVID. But this winter, the coronavirus tore through Japan. The country's death rate from COVID among seniors soared. Now Japan is getting ready to remove all pandemic safety precautions, while the challenge of protecting the elderly has not gone away. From Tokyo, Tsanka Siripala has more.
This group of 20 women get together twice a week for their love of traditional folk dancing. Everyone here is over the age of 80. They all live in the same small suburb in West Tokyo. They dance in pairs for 2 hours, practicing Victorian gallop, polka and waltz. The quick steps, hops and curtsing look easy until you see the intricate and interweaving group coordination. As a COVID-19 safety measure, everyone wears a mask, sanitizes their hands and wears white fabric gloves. There is a lot of hand-holding. Mariko Yokoyama started folk dancing more than 2 decades ago and joined the group 4 years ago. She says she isn't concerned about catching COVID-19. It will be really difficult if I caught COVID-19 since I'm 82 years old, she says. But I take all the recommended prevention steps and I got my 5th COVID-19 vaccine recently. Kozue Kawabuchi is 88. I look forward to coming to folk dance club. I come with my mask and it doesn't come off, she says. I make sure I'm here every time. These seniors are determined to dance as long as it's physically possible for them. But some experts are concerned about the 36 million Japanese citizens who are over the age of 65. Dr. Kenji Shibuya is an epidemiologist and director of policy research at the Tokyo Foundation. He says the elderly are vulnerable because of their pre-existing health conditions.
The death was not necessarily due to COVID directly, like severe pneumonia, but rather the COVID was indirect or contributory factor to accelerate or worsening pre-existing conditions such as Alzheimer's.
Last year, thousands of emergency patients with COVID-19 symptoms were turned away from hospital and scores died at home. Dr. Kazue Fujita says Japan's decentralized medical system was a big part of the problem. She works at Nippon Medical School Hospital in Tokyo. It has one of the largest emergency wards in the country.
Easy access じゃなくなってしまった。
The medical system is very difficult to access for elderly patients, she says. We tend to specialize. For instance, I'm a respiratory physician, so normally I would only diagnose respiratory conditions. There are not enough general practitioners who can look at everything. As a result, there aren't enough doctors who can treat a large number of COVID-19 patients all at once. That's why Dr. Fujita is concerned about upcoming changes. In May, COVID-19 will be downgraded from a deadly disease to a lower level Category 5 disease, on par with the seasonal flu. The Japanese government is eager to see the economy rebound after the country closed its borders to foreign tourists for 2.5 years. The government says the move will reduce some bureaucracy surrounding COVID-19 hospital intake and also allows any medical facility to treat the disease rather than the current COVID-19 designated facilities. Epidemiologist Dr. Kenji Shibuya says Japan can expect an uptick in infections this coming spring and summer, but these changes will help.
They can go to the clinic and get tested. They start treatment or they go back home and are supervised by the GPs.
The removal of COVID-19 health measures also means government subsidies for COVID-19 hospital beds will be phased out. Dr. Kazue Fujita is skeptical whether medical facilities can respond to a future COVID-19 outbreak. She says regulations that could ease staff shortages have not been resolved.
The medical staff が
If a nurse catches COVID-19, they can't come to work, and we don't have enough staff to accept COVID-19 patients, she says. In addition, Dr. Fujita says the price of personal protective equipment, PPE, has skyrocketed and it limits how many COVID-19 patients they can accept.
Protection, 今, and free protection, or reduce the symptoms.
One thing is that medical doctors need to change their mind when it comes to PPE, she says. Currently, we do full PPE, but if we simplify it, we could treat more patients. Dr. Fujita says there isn't enough funding or time to make the changes the Japanese hospital system needs in order to be ready for another outbreak. Dr. Kenji Shibuya, on the other hand, supports the relaxation of COVID-19 medical rules, but is urging people in Japan to use their common sense when it comes to the elderly.
I would recommend to wear a mask when you are going to meet with these frail and fragile elderly people. And of course, if possible, to get tested with a rapid test will be useful.
For now, at the community dance studio, the seniors are looking forward to their public performance. It's something they haven't been able to do since the pandemic began. For The World, I'm Tasanka Sirapala in Tokyo.
We'll be right back with more in the next half of the show. You're listening to The World. More junk food, more screens, and more time being inactive.
It's almost like the default response to this environment is actually weight gain.
Worldwide, it's accelerating an alarming trend. A new report says half the globe could be overweight or obese within a dozen years. We'll find out how some countries are trying to head that off. Coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The economic crisis gripping Cuba appears to have no end in sight. Food shortages, blackouts, and a lack of jobs are driving hundreds of thousands of Cubans away from the island. For the ones returning to help family members, it is tough to see what's happening. Cuban filmmaker Armando Guerra is based in Spain, but knows well what the Cuba of today is like. He's originally from the city of Camagüey and teamed up with reporter Jerry Haddon to bring us this story of an island in crisis. Their account begins in Spain.
Armando and I met years ago in Havana. Today we make documentary films together. I'm in Barcelona, Armando in Valencia. That's where he was last month as he prepared to visit his family.
It's a rainy day here in Valencia and it sets 9 Celsius. But in 2 days I'll be in Havana, Cuba. And then I'll take a car and drive for 8 hours to Camagüey. Central Cuba. Can't wait to see my mom, my dad. Can't wait to hug them all.
One thing about Cubans going home to visit, they can't show up empty-handed. There's always a scarcity of something on the island. Cuba's isolated, a socialist country largely shunned by global markets. So today, Armando's driving to his local supermarket with a list.
We Cubans get a list from our family every time we visit the island. Hey, we need a little radio for your grandfather, or so-and-so needs notebooks. This time, however, the list is very different. My mom and my dad, the only thing they wanted was food, just normal food.
Armando's family isn't poor by Cuban standards, mainly because Armando's been helping them for years. But today's food shortages are hitting everyone.
So I think I have all the list. I have all the powdered milk, about 6 kilograms, which is about 60 liters, tuna cans, sausages, olive oil, some small medical kits, hygiene items in general, and, believe it or not, toilet paper. There's no toilet paper in Cuba at the moment.
Armando ends up filling 2 extra suitcases with the staples, then boards his flight. In Havana, he rents a car for his trip. It's stuffed with supplies, but he stops at a farmer's stall on the highway. Just to grab something fresh, some fruit, some tomatoes, onions. He drops about $12, not a lot if you're in New York, Berlin, or Madrid, but here...
That was almost 2,000 pesos. My mother's pension is 1,500 pesos, and I just blew it. In a bunch of bananas, some garlic, onions, and 2 pounds of tomato and a cabbage.
Back on the crumbling highway, Armando passes hundreds of hitchhikers. It's how most people without cars move around. They don't even have to put their thumbs out. Armando stops for 2 women.
Hola, ¿qué tal? Sí, voy a Camagüey, sí.
¿Suban?
Sí. ¿Suban, por favor?
They ask Armando if he's headed for Camagüey. Yes, he says, climb in. One of the women, Leani, is a doctor. She's traveling with her mother. Lucky you stopped, says Leani, with all the stuff that's happening. What, Armando asks. All the kidnapping, she tells him, people being killed. Cuba's a tightly controlled society, but crime has been going up as people become more desperate. Leani tells Armando, please don't pick up any more hitchhikers. It's too dangerous.
¿Y el salario está bien o no alcanza todavía?
How are your salaries, Armando asks. I'm earning 2,200 pesos a month, says Leani. She doesn't want to give her last name, as doctors need government permission to speak with reporters. 2,200 pesos is about $13. I bake cakes on the side, Leani says, to survive. As long as the work is honorable, she says, and I don't have to kill, steal, or sell my body, I'll do it.
Encantado. Cuídense mucho.
Armando drops off the women, exchanges contact information. They wish him a nice visit with his family. A few minutes later, he's nearly there.
It's incredible. I still know every corner of the city. It's always exciting to be back, honestly. But all the news from the last 2 years make me worry about my mom and dad here. In their old age, when things are supposed to be simpler, it's the opposite in Cuba. I'm 1 block away from home. 100 meters from... Oh, my dad is sitting on a chair. My dad is sitting on a chair outside.
Hey!
Armando Guerra there, greeting his family in Camagüey, Cuba, where food, gas, even medical supplies are in short supply. Tomorrow on The World, reporter Jerry Haddon brings us the reality on the ground for the Guerras and other Cubans during what may be the island's worst economic crisis in 40 years. Join us tomorrow for that here on The World. In Afghanistan today, girls and women are facing a harsh reality. When the Taliban seized power in August of 2021, they banned young women and girls from attending high school. Late last year, they barred women from working in most local and international aid groups. To find out how the international community is responding, we reached out to Rina Amiri. She's the U.S. Special Envoy for Afghan Women, Girls, and Human Rights and joins us from New York. Special Envoy Amiri, I'd like to start by getting your impressions of how difficult the situation is for girls and women in Afghanistan right now. What are they telling you?
Just last night, I was speaking with a group of 40 women in Afghanistan until 1 o'clock in the morning. What they describe to me is absolutely haunting and devastating. You know, there have been over 80 decrees in actions, 75% of them targeted against women and girls that have stripped away their rights at every level, from education to work to mobility to having any element of choice in their life. They are turning their sons away from them, their husbands away from them. One woman said that her child, her seven-year-old child, had come home and said, "I shouldn't be talking to you, Mama." And she said, "Why?" She said, "Because you're a demon." This is what his instructor had told him at school.
In a meeting like that, how do you come back to them with answers? I mean, if they don't have answers, what do you say?
I believe that what's most important is to be honest with them. I recognize how incredibly challenging and painful the situation for them. I hear them when they say that they feel that the international community has not heard them in the ways that they need to be heard. We have a situation where we have one of the worst human rights situations in the world, as well as one of the worst humanitarian situations in the world, which leaves us with difficult choices, even with the limited tools that we have at our disposal. What are the tools that the international community has? It's financial assistance. It's engagement and the Taliban's desire for greater normalization. It's sanctions. But I also note that I recognize that these women are leaders. They are not victims, and that they themselves are taking enormous risks. They are engaging the Taliban at the local level in particular, and they are looking for us to support them in concrete ways.
Special Envoy, can you give us a few examples of the kinds of things the U.S. government is doing for Afghan girls and women right now?
We have established the U.S.-Afghan consultative mechanism to bring Afghan women's voices into U.S. policymaking. Second, we set up the Afghan Women's Economic Resilience Alliance. And this is a public-private partnership that aims to bring support to women entrepreneurs, to support bringing virtual education for mentoring, capacity building.
I mean, noble efforts, but they stand against the Taliban that goes their own way. About a year ago, they promised to reopen schools in Afghanistan for everyone, including girls. 2 days later, they reversed the decision. So at this moment in time, what leverage does the U.S. government have with the Taliban to push for a reversal of that ban, for example, or establish any dialogue about their policies?
Every conversation that the U.S. government has with the Taliban, the key issue that is raised at the beginning of the conversation and continues throughout the conversation with the Taliban is that there is going to be no progress in normalization or any of the things that the Taliban want until there is progress in respecting the rights of the Afghan population, particularly women and girls. Right now, all of the assistance that the U.S. and the international community deliver to Afghanistan, it only goes through U.N. agencies. It does not go in any way through the de facto Taliban governance structures. And they want that change. They want a relieving of sanctions. On all of those areas, we've noted to them that there's not going to be any positive movement in that direction. We've also noted, you know, as long as they continue to go on this road, they are going to once again become the pariah that they were in the 1990s. And some of them have heard this. We see an increasing level of frustration among some of the Taliban leadership that see that, one, this is bad for them, but it's also taking Afghanistan in a direction that is going to lead to greater destabilization, greater poverty, and it's going to lead a failure on their part.
Well, and as you pointed out earlier, Special Envoy, you don't want to normalize the Taliban. So given all that, the work that you want to do assisting women and girls, how do you walk that line?
Yeah, I think the issue of normalization is incredibly important. It's important not just for Afghanistan, but it's important for hardline elements, extremist elements that are pushing against the rights-based agenda in Pakistan, Somalia, many other contexts. And if they see that there's a ceding of ground and a normalizing of what the Taliban are doing, that will spread to other contexts. So enabling the Taliban to do what they're doing to women and girls in Afghanistan puts women's rights at peril everywhere. And it's a message that we take to every capital. We caution other countries about moving in a direction that could potentially normalize the situation in Afghanistan. And we make that appeal throughout the world.
Special Envoy Amiri, there is a new worry facing Afghan women, this time women who were divorced under the previous government. Some of those who've remarried say they're considered now adulterers under the Taliban legal code. Are these women right to be concerned?
Yes, you know, Afghan women know to me repeatedly that what the Taliban are doing are contrary to the tenets of Islam. Islam, many Afghan women have noted, is one of the first religions that clarified women's rights to divorce, and all of this is specified. So what the Taliban are doing is anathema to what Afghan women see as them being empowered by their religion. And there is every reason for them to feel that the Taliban, while they claim to have ended the conflict, they have waged a war against women and girls the minute that they entered into Afghanistan as de facto rulers.
Rina Amiri is the U.S. Special Envoy for Afghan Women, Girls, and Human Rights. She joined us from New York. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Here's an alarming stat. More than half of the world's population will be overweight or obese by the year 2035. In other words, more than 4 billion people. That's according to a new report from the World Obesity Federation. The world's Bianca Hillier reports on the data and what countries are doing to put on the brakes.
When it comes to concerns over obesity, health experts and advocates say they've been ringing the alarm for decades.
I'm really glad that it's getting attention, but we've been saying this in different ways for a very long time.
Johanna Ralston is the CEO of the World Obesity Federation, a UK-based organization. She's particularly concerned about one population.
12 years from now, rates are going to they're going to double among children, and that's probably the part that's most disturbing.
According to the report, rates are predicted to double among boys and more than double among girls. That's a sharper rise than among adults. Many countries' national strategies are targeting this population by addressing school lunches.
So what we have done is look at the menus. We've brought in dietitians. We are trying to provide more healthy foods, more access to fruits and vegetables.
Dr. Sonia Brown leads the Ministry of Health and Wellness in Barbados. On a webinar yesterday, Dr. Brown said 1 in 3 children in Barbados are overweight or obese.
This is a large percentage of our population, I dare say.
She's giving them easier access to healthy food by making school lunches the cheapest option on the island. They cost about $1 per day. Education is also a key component of Dr. Brown's plan.
We are including the teachers and other auxiliary staff within the schools with respect to training, getting out the message out there, what is healthy and what we do not want to see in schools.
It's a multifaceted strategy rolling out around the world, including in Bahrain and South Africa. Their director of nutrition, Rebone and CA, is also looking at how kids are influenced outside of the classroom.
You know, marketing of unhealthy food. So we're looking at restricting marketing of unhealthy foods to children.
Chile was a global leader with this approach. In 2016, the country banned marketing food with high levels of salt, sugar, and fat to kids. It also imposed mandatory warning labels on those products. In 2020, some Mexican states took things one step further by banning junk food sales to people under 18.
It punishes people if they sell this kind of food to children.
Charlene Curiel is a food anthropologist in Oaxaca. In an interview last summer, she told me the law is supposed to fine stores if they sell junk food to kids. But it hasn't been widely enforced, and she says the government hasn't offered healthy alternatives.
The state never thought about how to substitute those kind of products, like fruits or vegetables or juices or something, you know, hot soups or whatever. But we never talk about that. We never talk about access to good food.
In part because of these shortcomings, Mexico's obesity rates have continued to climb for both children and adults. The World Obesity Federation's report predicts 47% of Mexico's adults will be obese in 2035. What counts as obese in the report is determined by body mass index, or BMI. Dr. Yoni Friedhoff teaches family medicine at the University of Ottawa.
Body mass index, very simply, is a measure of bigness. That is literally all it is measuring.
A person's BMI depends on their height and weight, and that's it. For example, someone who is 5'6 is considered overweight if they weigh more than 155 pounds. They're obese if they weigh more than 185 pounds. The tool has been widely criticized on an individual scale for a number of reasons, including the fact that it can't decipher what percentage of a person's weight is from their fat, muscle, or bone. But Dr. Friedhoff says it can be useful when looking at an entire population.
At the highest ranges of BMI, it absolutely seems to carry risk.
World Obesity Federation CEO Johanna Ralston acknowledges the faults of BMI.
But it's a tool that's most realistically available to get at global numbers.
Everyone I spoke with for this story emphasized that obesity is not an individual's problem. Ralston says behavioral, genetic, and environmental factors are at play.
We live in an environment now that actually encourages weight gain, that encourages unhealthy weight. And you can say it's made worse by companies that are marketing unhealthy products. And certainly, you know, our screen dependencies are not helping much. So it's almost like the default response to this environment is actually weight gain.
And it comes with a major price. Obesity can lead to a range of health problems, including heart disease, strokes, type 2 diabetes, and certain types of cancer. It can cut years off a person's life. Ralston is looking for governments to provide funding, training, and policy changes to combat the rising problem. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Coming up this weekend, the Oscars. The stunning documentary Navalny is up for an Academy Award in the category of Best Documentary Feature Film. It recounts that time in August 2020 when Russian opposition figure Alexei Navalny was poisoned with Novichok. The film takes us back to his recovery in a German clinic and his decision to return to Russia.
What to do with Navalny presents a conundrum for the Kremlin. Let him go and risk looking weak, or lock him up, knowing it could turn him into a political martyr.
Navalny, in his own words, reminds us why the Kremlin and Putin see him as the enemy.
If I want to fight Putin, if I want to be a leader of a country, I have to do something practical about it. Well, I have to kind of organize people.
Christo Grozev led the investigation into how Navalny was poisoned. He joins us now. He's with the independent investigative journalism group, Bellingcat. Christo, in addition to Navalny, you are also at the center of this film in many ways. There's, of course, that unforgettable scene that led to breaking news headlines around the globe where Navalny actually calls up the men you and Bellingcat identified as his would-be assassins. I mean, it's part deadly serious accountability, but also part prank phone call. What were you thinking as Navalny made one call after another until he landed on one of the men who actually spoke with him and confessed?
We had agreed to allow Alexei Navalny to do something that usually we would do as journalists, which is confront the subjects of our investigation. We thought we can combine that mandatory journalistic requirement with him getting some sense of justice for himself, confronting the would-be killers. But it didn't go as planned because we thought he would just be confronting them under his own name, and it never worked out until he switched gear and became a prankster. He said, let me just try to impersonate one of their bosses. And I said, well, this will never work because these are trained FSB security officers. They know your voice. He just said, well, don't assume competence. Tell me which of these people is the dumbest and I will give it a try. So I gave him a couple of names and it worked. I had an array of feelings during the call because it started with me being convinced that this is a reverse prank, that actually they know what's happening and this guy on the call is giving us fake data. But then he corroborated everything that I had found out and at some point started giving us even new names and new data. And then I was really shocked. I realized it's for real.
Now, before the end credits of Navalny, it's explained that you continue to investigate the fate of this chemist that spoke to Navalny, Kudryavtsev, that Navalny got to talk. You all agree that he's going to have some serious problems. Have you gotten any closer to learning what happened to him?
Yes, we were able to use the same sort of leaky data sources in the Russia data market to find out his COVID certificate. So we found that as of August 21, he was alive and even didn't have COVID. What I think happened is he was just given a desk job. He was moved out of special operations. I know that his wife left him, so that's at least some justice. I know that his neighbors posted photos of him in the elevator saying our neighbor was a killer. So there's some social justice.
Christo, let's talk about Navalny himself. You work directly with his team and with Navalny. What can you tell us about Alexei Navalny that we don't know?
I went into this interaction with him with some skepticism because I had followed him for years, I followed Russian politics, and I was never sure how much of a real, authentic politician he was and how much of a somebody who was like taking advantage of the political system and how much of a populist he was. And he had previously engaged with some unsavory characters in Russian politics, extreme far rights. And I confronted him head on that in my first days of talking to him. And he was not apologetic. He was very honest about why he did what he did. He said, I needed to find a place on the political spectrum in Russia, and I needed to consolidate the available unattached and affiliated forces with one goal, to create a coalition and to bring down this one-man rule. And even though I completely disagree with what he did 10 years ago or 15 years ago, I could understand and could appreciate his openness about it.
2 years on, Navalny is still in jail, and the film makes a point that pretty much all the people in his organization are working against Putin outside Russia. So with hindsight, what do you make of his decision to return?
I think he gave an example, and this has given enough people in Russia a hero to look up to. I don't think that now that the war is at play, that the same decision would have been appropriate at this point in time. Many, many of the young and best Russians are outside of Russia at the moment, trying to fight the regime from outside. So now I would say that if there's a chance for him to be traded or to get out of Russia, he should take this chance, because he has hundreds and thousands and maybe millions of people that he can work with from outside.
There's a shot of Navalny in prison at the end of the film. He does not look good. What's the latest you can tell us about his health?
It's a terrible situation where the regime is trying to use psychological and biological pressure on him to make him weaker and just break him as a man. And we know that he's alternated between solitary confinement, forced to stand up for most of the day. He has back pains that started after the poisoning that may or may not be related to nerve damage. Sometimes he's being put in a cell for two people where the other cellmate is sick with COVID or other forms of flu, or in one case with tuberculosis. So it's almost like they're using other cellmates as biological weapons against him. He's given injections without being told what they are, which seems to be psychological pressure on him, because somebody who was poisoned by the government being injected something which he's told is a cure without telling what it is, it does have a psychological toll. So it seems to be an ongoing psychological warfare against him. And I think he's probably the only person strong enough to withstand that. And I'm hopeful he can.
Of course, Navalny, the documentary, is up for an Oscar. It already won a BAFTA before that. You were not allowed to attend the ceremony last month in the UK, the BAFTAs, Christo, because of the security risk to you. And you said the entire audience at the BAFTAs. Late last year, the Kremlin put you on its wanted list. How concerned are you right now for your safety?
Well, concerned is a word that assumes that I'm afraid. I'm not afraid, but I'm very conscious of the high risk that I'm under. I've been warned by several law enforcement agencies that there are specific, clear, imminent, and dangers to my safety if I go back to my home country. I've had to amend my life, append it and amend it completely. I mean, I'm living separately from my family. That is a cost, and obviously I'm not happy with it, but the alternative is to stop doing what I'm doing. And I remember that when Navalny left Germany, one of the last things he told me before we parted is he said, well, trust me, from now on, you're number one on Putin's kill list. And I thought he was kind of exaggerating, but 2 years later, I feel that he was right.
Are you attending the Oscars this weekend?
I'm so far slated to attend the Oscars, and I hope the American organizers have a bit more bravery and courage than the British organizers, and so far it seems so.
I've been speaking to Christo Grozev, whose investigation into the poisoning of Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny was documented in the 2022 film Navalny, now nominated for an Oscar. Christo Grozev, great to meet you. Thank you for taking the time.
Thank you so much.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you again tomorrow.
This fall, listeners from around the globe helped us exceed our fundraising goal of $67,000. The following supporters span time zones and borders and help keep the world free and accessible for everyone. Patricia Goodwin, Graham Martin, Gwenda Roll, Francois Lizotte, Annie Armistead, Colette Blakey, Mimi Furman, Carla Nowak Fernandez, Barbara Glenn, Chelsea Isan. Thank you for helping us bring global reporting to millions of people around the world.